Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Debs Taylor, mum to Zara Taylor, to talk about Zara's life, her battle with anorexia, and the new APPG report on preventing deaths from eating disorders, which is dedicated to Zara. Debs is the operations and project manager at Dump the Scales, bringing a unique blend of lived experience, organisational expertise, and campaign passion to the team. As a devoted parent and carer with over a decade supporting her daughter through an eating disorder, she has become a dedicated advocate for improved awareness, support, and systemic change. Debs also serves on the UK Feast executive team and represents Feast within the Wales Eating Disorders Clinical Implementation Network. This conversation is a tribute to Zara's kindness, courage and determination to recover, and a call for urgent change in how eating disorders are understood and treated.
I am indeed.
Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Debs Taylor, whose daughter Zara Taylor lost her life and who the most recent APPG for Eating Disorders report was dedicated to. So hello Debs, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi Han, thank you so much for having me. That's really good.
How are you doing today?
All good. And like I was saying earlier, first podcast, so please bear with me.
Well, I also think possibly first podcast done on a boat for Full of Beans. So, you know, this is a whole load of firsts, which is wonderful. So did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Debs Taylor. I'm a mum of two, Nicholas and Zara. Devastatingly, Zara lost her life to anorexia nervosa. And I think I'm just kind of using that to campaign and to try and help make it a better service for others so it prevents others going through this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so inspiring whenever I hear you speak or talk to you in terms of how you are using your own experience and Zara's experience to then help other people. You know, I think that takes a lot of courage and bravery. So just thank you very much for doing that.
Thanks.
I suppose to start with, and I don't want to say, you know, give us an overview because that feels very disrespectful, but would you mind sharing a bit of your story and of Zara's story?
Of course. Yeah. So, no, to be honest, I love talking about Zara, maybe not so much her story, but about her. So if I introduced you to Zara, and, you know, obviously all of us mums think our children are just wonderful and perfect, and she is no exception. She was kind, loving, beautiful, clever, and generally pretty sassy most of the time. she basically had her family wrapped around her little finger growing up, and she, the time she needed to sort of take on the mothering role to her brother and myself, which I used to laugh at. Her brother, when he was little, did not laugh very much at that. But no, she was just a very caring, kind girl. She got on well with everybody. Family adored her. She excelled at school, which was amazing. But of course, I think she put a lot of pressure on herself as well. And from a sort of from a young age, Zara got really involved in an orphanage back in Zambia. So her father was living in Zambia at the time, and they would go back to Zambia every year. And yeah, she got involved in an orphanage there, and she got really close to them. So much so that she would come back home and she would, you know, do car boot sales or cake bake sales or things like that to raise money, buy stuff for the orphans, go back to see her dad, go and give him all the stuff they needed, which was, it was really special. She was just really kind-hearted. And she had gone off to Tanzania at one stage for a couple of weeks to work in their rural hospitals there, because ultimately that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to become a pediatric nurse and possibly work for these aid organizations and help out back home. So yeah, she was a very, very sweet, very kind, very loving girl. And then, yeah, anorexia kind of came knocking on our door. So she was about 13 when she obviously started getting all the symptoms. It took us a year to get her diagnosed. Going backwards and forwards to the GP, it started off with stomach pain. So then we were like changing her diet, taking out dairy, taking out wheat and all the rest. Now looking back at it, was obviously the wrong thing to be doing, but at the time we were just trying to sort her out. Her extremities turning blue half the time, and then they put that down to Raynaud's syndrome, and her period stopped, and then she was obviously losing weight. Eventually it got that bad that I actually took her to specialists in London, and after a couple of exploratory sessions, they diagnosed her with anorexia. So it took us a year to get diagnosed, but they were very quick to get her in because obviously by now she was critical. And we got her into her first inpatient unit, which was literally just down the road from us, which was really handy. But from there, Zara had 13 inpatient admissions to 9 different units over the 10 years. And it was, yeah, it was just horrific. I think, unless people have actually experienced it, it's so hard to explain just how horrific it is. It was just awful. And I think it was only sort of the last year or so that she'd spent at home. The rest of the time was inpatient units. Yeah, so it was not a very pleasant experience at all for her or for me and for her family, like her brother as well. I mean, he had to spend many Christmases in eating disorder units as opposed to normal family gatherings. So, yeah, it was not good.
Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for sharing. And it sounds, you know, that emotional strain of being in and out of hospital and the different admissions, and you know, I can imagine it's just so unbelievably difficult as a family, as well as, you know, for Zara as well. Throughout those different admissions, were there reasons she was discharged? Did she start to look better, or were there other reasons?
No, there were other reasons, really. The first couple of admissions, she was starting to get better, so we'd get her back into the community, and then it would go down again. So one of the units, she was in there for about nearly 2 years, and she was confined to her room in that whole 2 years. She was on a tube for most of those 2 years. So we had to try and find her somewhere else, because clearly after 2 years and nothing's changed, we had to move her. So we moved, and at that stage, she was also 3 hours away from home. She was up north. So for me, every weekend, it was just like, yeah, 3 hours up there, stay the weekend, 3 hours back. And if there was any problems in the week, it's just not easy just to jump in the car and go and help. So she was moved closer. Then that one didn't work out because they weren't in proper eating disorder unit. So she was moved to another one. That one she was at for a year, and again, no progress as such. So we moved her to London, and with that one, I think her final one, I tried to find one where they had the day patient unit as well, so that we could have a proper step down, because a lot of them, they're not. A lot of them, they feed them up, get them to a sort of fairly okay BMI, and then send them out, you know. So at least the last one had a bit of a step down facility with it, so that's why we got that. So yeah, various different reasons, but generally not many times was she ever at a decent weight.
And I mean, I'm just thinking in my head, you know, how that's deemed almost acceptable, how that's something that can just keep happening to somebody in terms of, you know, when I speak to people involved in eating disorder treatment, I don't think I've ever met anybody that would say, oh, the treatment is putting somebody on an NG tube and leaving them in a room.
Yeah.
So how that was being allowed just doesn't really seem to add up.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't add up. Unfortunately, I don't know. They don't. You know, it's really difficult, because I kind of feel that the clinicians feel like we blame them. And I know we do and we don't, but we kind of want to work with them because we know our children, and, you know, we want to help. Throughout all the admissions, I would always sort of ask to have an appointment first with them, sit down, ask them to please explain to me how they're going to, you know, focus on Zara, how they're going to get her sorted. I always, in the beginning, I used to believe that actually they would just fix it, but clearly you can't just fix it. But yeah, I mean, I think I had a really good relationship with Zara, so she trusted me, and I knew that I could be able to, you know, get her to get on board with the treatment they're working on. But they would look at me as the enemy, and I was the, you know, the mother who, there seems to be some attachment issue with the child, and I was always sort of interfering. But I think, they don't realize that actually, if we all work together and on individual patients rather than a one fits all, I think they would have better outcomes. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a professional as such, but I do believe that, this is an illness that needs to be worked together and alongside each other.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm not a professional either, but I think when you have spent as long as you have in and out of services and supporting somebody who, as you say, you knew Zara very well, you had that close relationship, it's that collaboration, isn't it, that is really required in order to help people get better. I mean, I guess this is kind of a difficult question to ask, but I'm thinking, what would you have said were the biggest kind of pitfalls within Zara's treatment that you would have done something different?
So, first of all, I think there's a serious lack of compassion, and I found the treatment very punitive, I guess. So, I think that staff, and I'm including agency staff with this, need to be trained in eating disorders before they come in and start looking after patients with eating disorders. And there needs to be a compassion. There's still a lot of blame culture out there. Oh, well, there was, sorry, when Zara was in, like it was all her fault. And she needs to sort herself out, and she needs to be the one to get better. And yes, ultimately it was her decision, I guess, to make that leap to get better, but she can't do it on her own. So yeah, compassion. I think within the different units, there needs to be some sort of continuity. You know, it was a case of we'd go to one unit, she'd have been sort of eating okay, but then they would take her back down to the starter feeding plan. So she would end up losing weight. They would have to go through the whole story and everything again. So yeah, there was just no continuity between units. She went from an adolescent unit into an adult unit. And that was just, wow. A bit of a shock to all of our systems because the difference in treatment is huge. I think working with parents is a big thing and listening to the patients rather than just telling them this is what they listen to them and work with them and the parents. I think those would be the main things. I think also for parents, just to try and educate themselves as much as possible. Because in the beginning, I was absolutely clueless. I had no idea about eating disorders. When the one lady said to me, oh, she's got an eating disorder, I was like, what on earth is an eating disorder? So you really have to educate yourselves.
Yeah. I think it's like what you said earlier about, you know, when you thought that Zara was struggling with stomach issues and cut out dairy and what have you. And looking back now, you maybe realise that wasn't the right thing to do. But I was speaking about this on another episode the other day in terms of you don't know what you don't know. And you don't know it until you know it. Until and, you know, you know it. We can look back and be, you know, critical of ourselves for our actions. But ultimately, you were trying to do the best thing for your daughter with the little knowledge at the time that you had.
Yeah.
So I think what you're talking about, compassion, parents having compassion for themselves as well, to know that they're not going to have the answers, but, you know, damn God, are they going to try?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that you mentioned as well, which I think, you know, feels really important to me, and it's something that I keep hearing in a lot of conversations, is that actually often with recovery, it's the person who's struggling with an eating disorder reaches a point of wanting to recover. And I think it can sound very sort of, well, you've just got to choose to recover and kind of simplify it when it's put like that. But I do think that that's often a role for the clinician, is to almost explore for somebody what recovery could be about. So it's not just getting their weight up and things like that, which is obviously important. But actually helping them to see what life could look like if they did recover, and give them that sort of like inspiration for reasons to recover. But as you said, even if they've got that, that doesn't then mean that they're going to be able to recover on their own. You know, eating disorder recovery requires so much work. So to just almost rely on somebody to get that inspiration themselves and be good and go ahead is, you know, that's only kind of a 5% of the story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I know, like, towards the end, I'd say in the last 18 months, Zara was desperate to recover. She had had enough. She just wanted out of it. And that was the perfect opportunity. And I remember saying to one of the doctors, one of her psychiatrists, is that, you know, Zara wants to recover. We need to work on this. We need to now encourage her and start helping her find a way to recover. And I remember her saying to me, Debs, just take it slowly. It's fine. You know, things change. It was almost, she kind of like dismissed it. And I was like, but this is the perfect opportunity when she's saying that she wants to recover. Let's jump in there with all our feet and just help this girl recover. So, yeah, it was a struggle. And it does 100% needs everyone involved. It was her and I trying to get her to recovery. And, well, you know, it's just a hard job. It needs more than just her and I. Does need specialist care.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have trained professionals, isn't it? To you know, walk with people on that journey, which I think, you know, often does require time and patience. But if somebody in particular has got that kind of, even if it's the teeniest, tiniest glimmer, as you said, you've got to work with that because that's the kind of catalyst for somebody's recovery. Obviously, we've spoken about the fact that Zara did lose her life. Would you mind telling us a bit about what happened there?
Yes, yeah, sure. So, like I say, it was probably about a year that she was at home. And she struggled a lot in that year. I mean, the eating disorder was really, really strong. But like I say, she was wanting to get better. And we had been trying to ask. So she'd been discharged from her eating disorder services, put into the community mental health team. Unfortunately, her psychiatrist at the time had no idea about eating disorders. So he was kind of being guided a bit by the eating disorder unit. He was another one who kind of felt like I was interfering. They more or less left us to it. And I think Zara had tried writing letters because I think you'll find a lot of parents become really good letter writers within the whole eating disorder period because we feel like no one's listening. So we just pump out letters left, right and center. And eventually I said to Zara, listen, you know, they keep saying you're over 18, you're an adult. It has to come from you. So she then sat down, she wrote a letter to the CCG saying to them, listen, I want recovery. I need help with it. I don't want to go to an inpatient unit. I would like to try this outpatient unit or day patient unit, but it's private and would they help with funding? And they were like, okay, well, that's fine, but we need your psychiatrist's approval. And he was so against it. He was just, I think he wanted her to go to yet another unit where she would have to stay for a couple of years. And we're like, it's been 10 years in eating disorder units. It's not working. We would like this day patient unit. So anyway, we fought about that a lot. And yeah, I got to the stage where I think Zara was just like, I'm exhausted. I cannot do this anymore. And yeah, her only way out was to take her own life, which was, yeah, horrendous. That's the worst day of my life and my family's. And I 100% believe it could have been prevented, which makes it even worse. But yeah, I think we've just got to use that now to help the country get back on its, well, not back on its feet, but help to get the eating disorder services to a better state so we can prevent that from happening to others. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you so much for sharing. And I think it is, when you share your story, it is just heartbreaking. And I don't think heartbreaking even, you know, suffices as the words to use, because as you said, it sounds something that could have been absolutely prevented if people just listened to what you were saying and what support was required. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that, and I mean, I've said this a thousand times in the podcast, but I think a role of a clinician is to hold hope, that there is hope of recovery. And part of that, I think, is listening to the patient and listening, you know, speaking with them about what they think could be best for them. Because, you know, I think often in eating disorder treatment, people can almost be seen as their eating disorder rather than an actual person that has insight, that has knowledge, that knows themselves very well. So to work together, as you said, collaboratively, and listen to what that patient wants. And ultimately, you know, even if that had happened and Zara had gone to outpatient and it wasn't as successful as she'd thought, after 10 years, would you not think it's time to try something different?
Exactly. And I think also another thing is that they tended to consider her a complex case. And I think sometimes that's just the wrong terminology for someone, because for her to be called a complex case, basically she's feeling like, well, it's her fault that she's complex. Whereas actually part of me thinks, well, is it the clinician's fault that it's complex? Can they not sort it out? Why is it complex? You know, should they not get more knowledge so that it's not so complex? But ultimately she did. She thought it was her fault. She thought she would never get better. And like you say, they should be holding hope. One clinician said to me, treat her like she had stage 4 cancer. And I'm like, really? How do you hold hope with that? You know, it's honestly, some of the things that have been said are just unbelievable. So yeah, like you said, it's their job to hold hope and to pass that hope on to the patient and to the families. Yeah. But having said that, I also don't want to be the mum that's always blaming the clinicians, because I really, really want to work with clinicians. And I think if everyone worked together, I really do think it would help. Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's so wonderful. And I'm just so inspired by you, because despite everything, you're still so positive. And I mean, I have always said that on the podcast, in that I almost feel sometimes like the bridge between patients and clinicians, because I, you know, sometimes work with patients, sometimes work with clinicians. And I think there's often a mismatch between the two. And I would never want on the podcast for clinicians listening to think that we're saying that they're all crap and they don't do their job and they don't care and what have you. I think there's a big element of lack of resources, lack of funding, lack of education.
Yeah.
But I think also these conversations are a fantastic opportunity for patients and carers to share to clinicians what could be better, what could they do, recognizing that I have the hope that they are doing their absolute best.
Yes.
I don't think you would work in eating disorders if you didn't want to help people get better. And I can completely understand that, you know, at some point I'm sure clinicians get to a stage where they think, I just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And that's okay to think, but it's communicating that in a way that is supportive rather than this is terminal.
Yeah, exactly. And it is understandable that if they get to a point where they don't know what to do, because if everyone knew what to do, we wouldn't be in this whole situation, the crisis that we've got going on, would we? But like you say, if they can just put their hands up and admit, okay, we need to try and do something else, try something else, maybe get someone else on board. Instead of just using the blame, I think it definitely needs just more compassion.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe, I don't know whether blaming the patients is the right phrase, but, you know, using terminology like complex or severe and enduring or longstanding or terminal, kind of addressing the elephant in the room that what we're doing currently isn't working.
Yeah.
But we're going to try something different, and that might not work either, but at least we're trying, because hopefully there will be something that we get, like we would get somewhere, and that works. And I think that for me, is where we really need to go in terms of eating disorder treatment, is not having a fixation on, because it's the gold standard treatment, therefore it's going to work for everybody. Because I think, you know, of all the people I've spoken to, there's various treatments that have worked for different people. But I think it's having that motivation to just keep coming back and trying something new and seeing how it goes, and just addressing the fact that this might not be the thing, but we're at least going to try it.
Yeah, 100%. Definitely.
Yeah. Which I suppose, in a sense, links quite nicely to the APPG report. And obviously that was dedicated to Zara. I wondered if you would be able to kind of tell us a little bit about what the APPG report means.
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, after losing Zara, I couldn't just sort of sit back and do nothing. And I obviously got involved with Hope Virgo and her Dump the Scales campaign. And she's been brilliant, including me with everything. And obviously with Hope now being the secretary for the APPG for eating disorders, that kind of got us the open door to do this prevention of deaths and eating disorders report. And I think it's a very powerful report. I think because it's got lived experience and it's got professionals involved, it's really, really good. And yes, for me, it is very meaningful, because I'm hoping it will help save other lives. And with the report, I think what was really clear is that people are dying because the system is fragmented and it's underfunded and basically inconsistent. With the report, we're asking for a national strategy to be put in place, because there's no sort of uniform standard of care, and the training's kind of patchy. There's poor data coming through and seems to be sort of no accountability in place either. Basically, in the report, what we were asking for is so the confidential inquiry into the eating disorder related deaths, just to sort of understand what went wrong, learn lessons from it, and hopefully prevent future deaths. Then we wanted we've asked for a fully funded national eating disorder strategy, so that every person, adult or child, gets timely specialist care and it's not a postcode lottery. We have asked in the report for mandatory training for all frontline healthcare staff, and that's GPs, A&E, paramedics and agency staff, basically everyone involved, so that they can understand the risks of the eating disorders and act sort of quickly. Better data and accurate recording of deaths. We need to know the full scale of eating disorder deaths so that we can actually try and find a way to fix it. There's not enough information reported on it. Just an example is that for Zara's inquest, we had the loveliest of coroners. He really was. But his final outcome for Zara, he had put down unlawful killing, and that her death was contributed by the effect on her mental state of sexual abuse that she reported when she was had sustained it when she was younger. Nothing about eating disorders. So when we try and get information out of the system, that death won't be added onto it. So we really need better reporting of that and recording. There was a regulation and oversight of all eating disorders, so that's including private hospitals as well. There must be accountability. Better early intervention, relapse prevention and long-term support, and public health action and prevention. So just education in schools, anti-stigma, and educational campaigns, support for the families. Yeah, so that's basically what we were asking for in the report. And so for me, this report kind of means Zara's life and her death, and that it can lead to change, and it gives a little bit of meaning to the huge amounts of grief, and that her story actually matters. And so other patients' stories matter as well. And yeah, I think for the first time, it's something that I've seen, something sort of comprehensive and honest and solution focused. And again, it's not an attack at the clinicians at all. It is purely what we see needs doing, and let's all work together and let's try and find a way around it. And I do believe that if all these recommendations had been in place, I truly believe Zara would probably still be here. So it does have a lot of meaning, this report. And yeah, I just hope it helps.
I mean, and it's extremely comprehensive in terms of the requests that are being made. And I think when I read it, it wasn't a shock, because I know that these things aren't in place. But I think as you're reading it, you're like, how can they not be in place?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we completely appreciate the importance of them and how much they are needed.
Absolutely.
And I think it's very interesting what you were saying about the inquest for Zara's death, because I thought that you were maybe going to say that it was kind of listed that she took her own life.
Mm, yeah.
But the fact that there was reasoning.
Yeah.
And the reasoning didn't include the eating disorder, it feels very strange that that's almost being hidden on the report, in a sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I say, how many others are like that, you know, that we miss when we're trying to get records of it? So coroners should also be on that list for education as well. And like I say, I mean, we did have the loveliest man. He was very kind, very caring. But yeah, I don't think he understood eating disorders at all.
I find it's one of those things that, in the same sense, an eating disorder can impact anyone. You know, we know that it doesn't matter what age, gender, religion, race, culture, sexuality, it can impact anyone. It almost, for me, feels like, you know, there's nobody within the medical profession that shouldn't have an awareness of eating disorders, because ultimately they all could come across somebody that is potentially presenting with signs of an eating disorder. Maybe they aren't aware that they have an eating disorder, or they are aware and they're seeking out for support, but, you know, they might be met with a medical professional who doesn't know where to signpost or doesn't know what signs and symptoms to look out for. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that I can't think of anyone that, I mean, I personally, in an ideal world, think that everybody in the whole entire world would be getting the training, because ultimately, you know, whether you're a teacher, a doctor, but you know, literally anything, if you could be there to support somebody to kind of recognize those signs and signpost them. In terms of the report, if people are listening and thinking, you know, maybe this story resonates with them or they want to get involved and help, is there anything people can do in order to support the APPG report?
Absolutely. So if they go on to the dumpthescales.org, they can download the report, read the report, but they can also, there's templates to write emails to their local MPs to try and get their local MPs on board and help support this through Parliament. Because obviously the more MPs we get on board, the better, and the more voice we have, get it through.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's anybody that wants to support, you know, doing so in sharing a letter, speaking to your MP, contacting them in any which way, that's going to be really helpful and really powerful to get this, you know, seen by the people that can kind of action things and make change. And I think it was it a couple of weeks ago when Richard Quigley spoke about it in Parliament and Keir Starmer, you know, responded to that. And, you know, I think things like that are just incredible, that the work that you are doing is being seen and being heard. And really, you know, I'm very sure that this will evoke change.
Yeah. Honestly, Hen, I hope it does. I really do.
Thank you so much, Debs, for sharing your and Zara's story. It's such a incredibly powerful and, you know, ultimately devastating story. But as you said, if it can be used to make change, then, you know, hopefully we're honouring Zara in the best way possible.
Yeah, I think so. And I think she'll be looking down thinking, thanks, guys. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
And thank you so much. And let's see how the report goes.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.